Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Today, with paranoia about the bear reaching Cold War proportions, Sean Guillory reviews the rich history of Russophobia in the West. And at the bottom of the hour, Larry Bartels reviews our standard theories of democracy and how they apply to a polity that knows and cares little about politics. First, Russia. It's been bizarre, hilarious, and distressing to watch people, mostly partisan Democrats, freaking out about Russian meddling in U.S. affairs, as if we didn't help Yeltsin steal the 1996 election and then cover up the massive fraud, and as if we hadn't surrounded the country with NATO bases. And it's also bizarre and distressing, and only slightly hilarious, to find liberals cheering on the CIA's obvious attempts to destroy Trump. I hate Trump and everything he stands for, but he was legally elected, and it's a very bad precedent to look to the intelligence community, I love that term, Robert Putnam would be pleased to know that they don't bowl alone, to get rid of him. It's a mistake to think that he's so uniquely awful that we should get rid of him by any available means. Trump's nativism, his hucksterism, his repressive tendencies all have deep roots in American history and in the more mainstream Republican Party today. Get rid of him and you still have those things to fight. And the resistance that's been mobilized over the last few weeks looks like something we'd need to conduct that fight. Get rid of him, and the pleas for healing and national unity will cause that resistance to dissipate. CIA-engineered coups are bad, no matter how awful the target. And now Sean Guillory. Sean has a PhD in Russian history and writes in podcasts about Russian and broader Eurasian affairs from his online headquarters at Sean's Russia blog. You can find it, unsurprisingly, at seansrussiablog.org. He has a piece about the history of Western Russophobia on inrussia.com. Sean Guillory. As a student of Russia, what do you make of the prominence of Russia in the American imagination right now?
I mean, it's quite extraordinary because, you know, for a long time, Russia wasn't front and center in terms of a concern, in terms of a fear and concerns of a threat, only until the last couple of years ago, particularly beginning in 2014. But since the 1990s, besides the fact that Russia was seen as a hope in the 1990s by the Clinton administration, it's seen as by some as a declining power. It's seen as some as irrelevant, right? Zimbabwe with nuclear weapons. But now it's really shifted to the forefront of some major threat to, you know, not just American interests, but it's often categorized as a threat to Western civilization as such. And I think that this does really hark back to the Cold War, even though I flat reject the idea that we're in a new Cold War. I think it's wrong to even conceptualize it like that. But it does bring up and revive certain memories of that period of the hot parts of the Cold War, the 1950s, 60s, and particularly the 1980s. So it's certainly tapping into that, I think, that underlying psychological view of Russia that's existed in the United States for, you know, in the 20th century. So, yeah, it's Russia's back in the American mind.
And there's an article in the Wednesday edition of the British Telegraph saying that Russia is going to be interfering in at least three European elections forthcoming.
Right.
So, you know, as you say, Western civilization, it's not just the United States, but their dastardly fingers will be in at least three elections coming up in Europe. Is this attribution of a sinister power to Russia fair to this country? I mean, what kind of shape is Russia in? Is it capable of doing all these dastardly deeds around the world?
They certainly try. They certainly try to mobilize the resources to try to shape and put their imprint on elections, particularly through some of their media that's broadcast outside of Russia, you know, state-funded media like Russia Today or something like this. But I think it's wrong to overestimate the amount of influence that Russia has over, you know, the average European voter, let alone the average American voter. I just don't think it comes into people's consciousness. I mean, people vote for a variety of reasons, and I seriously doubt that Russia is one of those reasons. I mean, maybe for some who are really kind of into this stuff with, you know, being concerned about Russia, but it's hard to say for the average voter. I think one of the problems, and this goes to my general frustration with how Russia is dealt with, there's this tendency to overestimate the amount of power it has. It certainly is an important geopolitical country. It certainly has influence in its near abroad, particularly in post-Soviet states. But in Europe and particularly in the United States, this is just blowing up. I think this is doing more to add to some sort of myth of Russia rather than dealing with its reality. And you know, we saw how this became a problem during the Cold War, where this, you know, Soviet power was elevated, and the Soviet Union was much stronger than Russia today in terms of its soft power. But there was a tendency to overestimate and inflate the amount of influence and power that the Russian government has during the Soviet period, and you see this tendency again. And I do think that this goes back to an image we have of Russia as some kind of insidious, covert, shadowy, distrustful, conniving place that, while it may have those elements, it's certainly not the driving force to how it conducts itself in foreign relations.
Yeah, so let's talk about the history of Russia in the American imagination. It's got deep roots, right? This view of Russia is somehow frightening and sinister.
Yeah, but not as deep as, you know, as we might assume. It doesn't have the same deep roots as it has Russophobia. And here I would define Russophobia as the belief that Russia is not just exercising its concept of foreign interests, but has intent to take over the world, has a plan to take over or destroy Western quote-unquote civilization. This is what I would define as Russophobia, as they're trying to infiltrate and take over. But in the United States, this belief is actually quite recent historically. It only begins really in the late 19th century and really comes to fore after the Russian Revolution in 1917. But In Europe, it's a different story. In England and in France, there's long roots of Russophobia beginning around the early 19th century. You know, anyone who's read a biography of Karl Marx will know that Karl Marx was a very committed Russophobe, and actually hooked up with one of the main representatives of Russophobia in England, David Urquhart, in the mid-19th century to propagate the view that one of the prime ministers of England was essentially a Russian agent. But this didn't exist in the United States, not as a major phenomenon.
In this piece, you talk about the Testament of Peter the Great. What was that about?
Right. So this is a document that was a forgery that came out, appeared in around 1812, that propagated the idea that when Peter the Great died, he wrote a document that essentially gave the plot of Russia to, you know, take over the world. And this was circulated in the 19th century. In fact, Napoleon I demanded that the French press actually begin writing articles to undermine Russia's reputation in France and to portray them as some great terror or great fear. But this didn't really take hold in the United States. It was published in 1843 in an American newspaper. But even then, even in that newspaper article that included the text of the Testament, they said, well, you know, relations with Russia, between Russia and the United States are amicable, and they will stay like this for a long time. So it really didn't sink in the level that we found in some European states at the time. And that makes sense, actually, because just on a geopolitical level, you know, the United States isn't a great world player in the 19th century. It's far away from Russia. There's not a lot of direct geopolitical confrontation. Whatever contacts there are quite friendly or the cooperative. There's a mutual shared concern over French and British power by both Russia and the United States. So they come together in this shared concern about European great powers rather than themselves.
And did it take the Russian Revolution to darken the image of Russia in the United States, or did it happen before that?
No, this happened before. I mean, it's a contradictory discourse, because on the one hand, Russia was seen by some as by some Americans as a kindred nation, as a nation that shared certain historical trajectories, that shared, you know, a history of human bondage, both in Russian serfdom and American slavery, that were basically abolished a couple of years apart. And of course, the geographical vast lands of the prairie in America, the Russian steppe, the imagination of settlement, expanding as a continental empire, as a multi-ethnic, multilingual society. I mean, a lot of these shared qualities were picked up by both Russians and Americans as Russian-Americans sharing some sort of historical destiny.
I'm speaking with Sean Guillory, blogger and podcast host. This quote from Walt Whitman is interesting. He said that the two countries share a historic and divine mission.
Right. And both the United States and Russia shared a concept of manifest destiny, that they were given the land to expand the land and develop it, Russia all the way to the Pacific Ocean and America all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And they shared this sense of settlement. From what I understand, some scholars are starting to look into this a little bit more, of this shared conception of the prairie and the steppe. And I'm really curious to see what they find. But there is a lot of admiration. And even in the early Soviet period, too, I mean, you can find in some of Lenin's writings a lot of praise for American ingenuity, the adaptation of Taylorism to Soviet production. But it changes, of course, I think. I mean, for the Russians, I think it there already is an anti-Americanism that comes out of the Russian Civil War amongst the Bolsheviks, but this really comes to fore once you get into the 30s and 40s. But in the United States, alongside this image of Russia as a kindred nation, there is always a discourse of it as a symbol of despotism, a symbol of backwardness. This was articulated alongside of it. But things really change, and a historian by the name of David Forlengzon pointed this out in his wonderful book that I encourage everyone to read, The American Mission in the Evil Empire. It was published about 10 years ago. And that looks into the mission on a part of American intellectuals and the American government to, quote unquote, free Russia. The image of Russia in the United States begins to change in the 1880s. As under Alexander III, the Tsarist state becomes incredibly more repressive. There are anti-Jewish pogroms in Ukraine after the assassination of Alexander II. There's a major crackdown and repression of the Russian revolutionary movement. And so Russia is seen as going backwards. It's going, if it existed parallel with the United States and its historical trajectory, with Alexander III, it seems to go off those rails. And that increases even more, particularly after the Russian Revolution.
Yes, and then it becomes the focus of evil in the modern world. And
right.
Reagan's great phrase.
Right. But even the early days of the Russian Revolution, right? I mean, 100 years ago next week, there was a lot of enthusiasm amongst people who were organized against Russian despotism, like George Kennan, the first George Kennan, not the one that becomes a diplomat. His early travelings, he was a Russophile until he was traveling in Russia in the 1880s and 1890s and started to meet Russian revolutionaries in exile, and he turned and became incredibly more Russophobic. But if you look at what he was saying in the early days of the Russian Revolution, this was praised as Russia is finally going to be a great democratic nation like the United States. You even had American socialists who were anti-Russian, or at least anti-Tsarism, saying things like, one day Russia will become a United States of Russia. So, in Forlengzon's book, he clearly shows how a lot, and this is typical, I think, in most American imaginings of other countries, that the goal is to mimic the United States, is to become like the United States, to really be considered a democratic, free, progressive society. It's quite a lot of narcissism involved in this.
Yeah, that's the American national disease.
Right.
But now that we have actually what seems to be some kind of narcissist in the Oval Office, the Russophobia is taking on massive dimensions. And it's just amazing to see the rebirth of a lot of Cold War rhetoric without, a post-communist Russia. But we're still hearing very many of the same tropes that were used to demonize the Soviet Union.
Right, right. And those tropes, I think, are always repackaged, transferred historically and repackaged. I mean, if you look at the Western discourse of Russia, in the United States and also Western Europe from the early 19th century to the present, you'll see repeated tropes kind of repackaged for the time and deployed once again. They're never really new. Like, for example, I mean, I pointed this out to you on social media a few months ago, this presence of Russia as an octopus, which comes out of the European scene in particularly Britain and also Germany, of Russian as this, you know, eight tentacled beast that's has not only the Russian people in its tentacles, but it is reaching across both Western Europe, but also Eurasia in general. This image is recycled repeatedly in the 19th century and in the 20th century. I mean, you can find images on the internet of Stalin, for example, and communism as the octopus. You can find more updated image of Putin as the octopus. So this persistent belief that Russia is out to dominate the world or to take over the world, that it's inherently imperialistic, is recycled again and again. And, you know, some of those things about, say, its imperialism, you know, I wouldn't say that it's inherently imperialistic, but it certainly has been imperialistic.
Well, yes, the United States is not innocent to that charge either.
Right. No, sure.
But now what we're seeing, this utterly surreal political scene now, where we see a bunch of liberals and Democrats cheering on the CIA, talking up the Russian threat as if they're something out of Hofstadter's paranoid style.
Yeah, we are seeing it. And again, this is another thing in the image of Russia that's recycled, right? As I mentioned a little while ago, is it as this shadowy, indecipherable enigma that we really can't know what they're doing and what they're saying. And they're always doing it behind the scenes. And you can see this kind of, you can see this rhetoric repeated in a lot of journalistic work and commentary on Russia today. You know, this recycling of active measures which is a thing from the KGB in the 1970s, of reflexive control, all of these methods that the KGB used in its intelligence and counterintelligence operations. Now they're being elevated to the modus operandi of the Putin government. Like, this is the way that they function. Even the term hybrid war, which is another one that suggests a very covert, sneaky, shadowy means of waging war, has come to the fore. And it's weird to see Democrats seeing this, like taking on the Russian, you know, Russophobia as its way to understand or even combat Trump, just because for the most part, that discourse has mostly been found on the American right. But it also just shows how the image of Russia has quite infected the American consciousness.
You know, I hate it. Trump as much as the next guy, no doubt about it. But it's just bizarre to see these Democrats cheering on the hidden state, the deep state, whatever you want to call it, the intelligence agencies, working with elite newspapers to destroy an elected president. Is this something that should be cheered on?
I don't think so. I mean, I personally have a lot of mixed feelings because, you know, I'm not going to shed any tears for, you know, the resignation of Michael Flynn or the resignation of any of Trump's people or Trump himself if that happens because of, you know, connections to Russia. If they fall, they fall. But at the same time, I think it's setting a really dangerous precedent. The first problem is that it's creating a really bad situation for having to deal with Russia. The United States doesn't have to be friends or allies with Russia, but I do believe that it has to deal with it. Especially, it has to come together with it around common interests. You just can't ignore it.
It's a very big country with lots of weapons.
Yeah, it's a very big country with lots of weapons. It's a country that has interests and really real interests in particularly its underbelly. It has 60 million Muslims that are part of the Russian Federation. So it has natural concern for things like the spread of, you know, Islamic extremism and terrorism, and it's been a victim of these things. So it has a definite concern that I think American interests and Russian interests can coincide. But by painting the Russian government and overblowing its activities, I think makes it really hard for the United States to actually deal with this. And the other problem is that by cheering on the CIA as a savior of democracy, is really dangerous. If I was an American politician, I'd be really concerned about the fact that anonymous intelligence people are leaking to newspapers information about connections without giving A, their names or any details to the information, or even really the names of people in Trump's circle besides Paul Manafort, who was honestly dealing with Ukraine, not Russia, not giving any of their names. I would be worried because it shows that the American deep state, when it comes together and wants to, it could potentially destroy an elected official.
I was Sean Guillory. You can find his podcast on Eurasian politics and culture at seansrussiablog.org. He misspoke towards the end of that interview. Russia doesn't have 60 million Muslims. It's more like 16 to 20 million, or 12 to 15% of the population. Still not a small number. You'll listen to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Was some of the Soviet national anthem performed by the orchestra of the USSR Ministry of Defense in 1977. Funnily enough, that tune, with new lyrics, is also the anthem of Putin's Russia. Yeltsin brought in the new national anthem after the USSR collapsed, but no one liked it, and when Putin succeeded him, he revived the old anthem. So this covers all the bases, Cold War nostalgia and fear of Russian expansionism today. Next, Larry Bartels. Bartels, a professor of political science at Vanderbilt, has been on this show twice in the past, first in 2005 to dissect what was wrong with What's the Matter with Kansas, and again in 2008 to discuss inequality in politics. For many years, he's been writing papers on, among other things, what the public knows and thinks about politics. His findings are not encouraging for those of us who want to believe in the possibility of democratic self-rule. Most people are indifferent to or even hostile to politics, know little about policy, and often what they know is wrong, and have nothing resembling a coherent political philosophy. He and his frequent collaborator Christopher Aiken published a book last April, Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Government, from Princeton University Press. The book contemplates what that picture of a detached and confused electorate means for democracy. It's not inspiring. Larry Bartels. So let's start by reviewing some of the theories of how democracy works, you know, what you call the folk theory and the retrospective theories, before we lay into the critiques of those. So the folk theory, what's that?
It's a kind of amalgam of ideas that go back a long way in political history and political theory. It would be hard to associate any one person with the whole set of ideas or claims, but if you think about, for example, Lincoln in the Gettysburg Address talking about government of the people, by the people, for the people. I think that's, in a sense, the heart of it. The idea is that ordinary citizens ought to control what the government does and that they can do that essentially by picking the people who are going to be their leaders and, in the course of picking them, transmitting to them some detailed mandate to pursue a given set of policies that are by some definition consistent with the preferences of the majority of citizens.
Now, this is usually framed as a good in itself and not necessarily a technique for delivering the best outcomes to people's lives, is it?
Well, often that distinction is glazed over. The assumption is that by following these procedures, we're going to produce something that's recognizable as good policy, at least in the sense that it corresponds with the preferences of ordinary citizens.
What about the retrospective theory?
Well, that's an old idea as well, but one that's been developed more recently and is, I think, more confined to academic discourse about how the political system works in the face of a lot of evidence suggesting that politics and government don't really work the way the folk theory suggests they should. Political scientists in the past half century or so have been casting around for other ideas about what might be good about the system that we have. And the idea that they've come up with is that even if ordinary people can't send detailed signals about their policy preferences to their leaders in the course of voting in elections, they can at least make some considered judgment about whether things are going well or badly under the incumbent government. And basically, the idea is that elections then serve as a referendum, which has two good qualities in theory, at least. One is that if they can discern the quality of their leaders, they can systematically vote to re-elect good leaders and throw out and replace bad leaders. The other is that in anticipation of that kind of process, leaders have an incentive to make sure that things go well, or at least as well as possible, with the idea that if the economy is flourishing and the country is at peace when the time they stand for re-election, they're likely to be re-elected, and if not, not. So on one hand, the idea is that this gives them an incentive to cater to citizens' interests, even if not their explicit preferences, and at the same time gives them a lot of flexibility to pursue the specific policies and means that they, as experts, discern will somehow produce good outcomes, even if the citizens themselves don't understand the details of the policymaking process or the connection between policies and outcomes.
What is your critique of the folk theory?
Well, mostly we just think it's impractical. This is drawing on the book that Christopher Aiken and I wrote and was published last year, a book called Democracy for Realists. A lot of the notions of what the folk theory thinks ordinary people ought to be doing just don't square very well with what we know about human behavior. Most people aren't that interested in politics. They're not all that well informed about political issues. They don't have clear policy preferences that would allow them to explain to elected officials in detail what they want in the way of policy with respect to every conceivable problem. And even if individuals did, there'd be problems in reconciling all those different complex views and aggregating them into an overall message that we could plausibly think of as being the will of the majority.
Now, sometimes, and I recite your critique to friends and colleagues, that they respond with a great deal of skepticism. Even people who are on the left politically, who are deeply invested in the idea that the system is somehow corrupt, they somehow still have this abiding faith that if somehow all these distortions of power and perhaps a dishonest media can be removed, then the public will, you know, flower into a marvelous, knowledgeable, self-governing body. You find these limitations on public knowledge and interest to be pretty longstanding and widespread, not just in the United States, but across the world, right?
Well, that's right. And the idea that we can overcome them somehow by just refining the process or getting the bad apples out of the barrel or something is also an idea that goes way back. If you think about the populist movement and the progressive movement, every time they experience dissatisfaction with the democratic process, their idea about how to fix it was to implement more democracy in often a simple-minded kind of way that would try to translate more directly the preferences of ordinary citizens into policy. So if you think, for example, about the introduction of direct primaries at the turn of the 20th century, the idea was that we'd get the party bosses out of the way and ordinary people could pick good candidates for office. We saw in 2016 the result of that kind of logic. We have a presidential selection process that gives ordinary citizens a lot of free rein to pick presidential candidates, and the guy they picked was Donald Trump.
Yes, I want to get to Mr. Trump at the end of this. But you paint a picture of, and you've been doing this for some time now, I've read your papers over the years and interviewed you, you paint a picture of a public that really doesn't know very much about politics, doesn't have anything resembling a coherent political philosophy, can believe contradictory things simultaneously, can change wildly from moment to moment and year to year. Is this some fault of education? Is this some fault of the media? How do you explain this persistent confusion and incoherence on the part of a public that is supposed to be the seat of power in this democracy?
Well, I think part of it is an inevitable result of the fact that politics is immensely complex. There's some small set of us who spend our lives studying the political process and the policymaking process, and we're certainly far from understanding really how it operates and what kinds of policies would be the ones that would be in the interests of ordinary citizens. And now we're expecting other people to do all of this as a kind of hobby in amongst all the other concerns of their lives. They're working, they're spending time with their families, they're pursuing all kinds of interests, but we also expect them to be constantly monitoring the political process and learning about policy issues and spending a lot of time acting in ways that would, in theory, although often not in practice, produce different political outcomes. But I think the situation is in some ways even more troubling than the one you described. There's a lot of evidence. We've gathered some of it in our book suggesting that most people are like this. They're not spending a lot of time paying attention to politics and they're not all that interested in it. But there is a set of people who are pretty interested in the political process. They're active politically. They spend a lot of time, if nothing else, just as a kind of hobby or because it's expected in their social circles, paying attention to politics. But what we find about them is that their views are often not any more rational than the views of people who are less interested because they are almost invariably pretty invested in loyalty to one side or the other of the party system. They're either pretty loyal Democrats or pretty loyal Republicans. And as a result, their view of what's going on in the world are often strongly shaped by these partisan loyalties. All of us, in our thinking about any aspect of life, try really hard to make the evidence of the world around us consistent with our views about how things ought to be. And so these better informed, more partisan people often are the most wrong if you ask them a concrete question about a matter of public policy or even an objective question about how things are going in the world. I remember looking at the results of a survey in 1988 as Ronald Reagan was leaving office that asked people questions about how things had gone under Reagan's presidency. One of the questions was whether inflation had gone up or down under Reagan. The answer was that it had gone from 12 or 13% down to 3 or 4%, but most Democrats said that inflation hadn't improved. And similarly, when Bill Clinton was president, he reduced the federal budget deficit by more than half. Most Republicans said that they thought it had gone up. So we all have a lot of capacity to misperceive the world in ways that are consistent with the way we'd wish it would be.
We sort of went astray here, but the retrospective model of how voters work, they will either reward or punish people for their time in office. They may not be able to foresee policy or evaluate policies and their merits for the future, but they can say, well, this guy did a bad job or a good job, and I'm going to punish or reward him appropriately. That model really doesn't necessarily fit the world either, does it?
Well, we have a kind of mixed verdict on that one. Empirically, we think it does fit the world a lot better than the folk theory does, and that's why political scientists have displayed a lot of interest in it. And so in our book, for example, we have an analysis of presidential election outcomes and find that you can predict pretty well which side is going to win on the basis of two things: how long the incumbent party has been in power, because the longer they're in power, the more likely people are to get disaffected and impatient and want to throw them out. And the other is how well the economy is doing at the time of the election. That's something that political scientists and economists have observed for almost half a century now as a really striking regularity about presidential election outcomes. And a lot of the early thinking and writing about that phenomenon cast it in terms of this retrospective theory of accountability and said, isn't it a great thing that people are voting on the basis of real economic conditions under the incumbent rather than clever television ads or the charisma of candidates? But what's striking is that all of those analyses focus on economic conditions over a very short period of time leading up to the election. So it's a kind of game of musical chairs, as one journalist once put it. If the economy happens to be growing in the 6 months before the election, the incumbent is pretty likely to get reelected, and if not, not. But if you're trying to assess the competence of the incumbent government in a broad way to produce prosperity, presumably you wouldn't want to just rely on how things are going in the last 6 months, because there's a lot of random fluctuation in economic conditions over short periods of time. So you would want presumably to take a sample that consisted of the entire time that the incumbent party has been in office and ask yourself whether the economy has consistently done well during that period. But that's clearly not what ordinary voters are doing. And so often they end up rewarding presidents for short-term growth, even in situations where the longer economic record has been pretty dismal, or punishing incumbents for short-term economic declines, even when they've done pretty well over the rest of their term. There's just not enough information in what voters are responding to allow them either to reliably choose competent administrators or to provide a strong incentive for incumbents to do anything other than to try to goose the economy around election time if they can. The other problem here is that in order to do this in an efficient way, citizens have to have some pretty good understanding of what outcomes in the world around them might plausibly be attributable to the success or failure of the incumbent's policies rather than just everything else that's going on in the world. And we find there as well that citizens aren't very good at making sensible judgments about whether the conditions that they observe really are even partly attributable to the incumbent leaders or not.
You write about how voters have punished incumbents for shark attacks or extremes of rainfall.
Right. So things are going badly. They feel bad about it, and they, as a result, feel bad about the way the country is going and vote against the incumbent president. In some sense, that makes sense, right? They're responding to a real condition that they feel, but on the other hand, as a way of holding the incumbents accountable, it's essentially random.
I'm speaking with Larry Bartels, who's the co-author, along with Christopher Aiken, of Democracy for Realists, Why Elections Do Not Produce Responsive Government, from Princeton University Press. Now, you also put forward a theory that what really determines voter behavior, or what heavily determines voter behavior, are identity groups. What do you mean by that?
Well, all of us in the course of our lives build psychological and social attachments to all kinds of groups. Maybe the most important one from the standpoint of politics is the political party, because it's the kind of broadest group. But we have attachments to all kinds of other ethnic groups and professional groups and religious groups and so on. And to one extent or another, many of those groups at least have political interests that get conveyed to their members in the course of daily life or the course of group activity. And so in large part, I think we absorb our views about the political world from the people around us through these kinds of groups. And as a result, the party system at any particular time is often roughly a coalition of one set of groups against another. And whichever side is in power tries to implement policies that it thinks will be more or less, you know, good for the groups that are part of its coalition, because the elected officials themselves have absorbed a lot of these loyalties and an ideology about what is good for their groups and what's important about the governmental process. And so for some people, that makes it an easy judgment whether they ought to be, you know, part of one group or part of another group. Sometimes people are conflicted because they have loyalties to lots of groups, some of which are more or less strongly attached to the Republican Party and some of which are more or less strongly attached to the Democratic Party. And these conflicted people tend to be the ones who aren't consistent partisans voting on one side or the other, but switching back and forth on the basis of what kinds of loyalties happen to be uppermost in their mind at a particular time, or what kinds of group interests seem to be salient in the political process.
What kind of group loyalties are you talking about here? Could you give some examples?
Some people are very invested in their professional worlds and belong to either explicitly organized or more informal professional groups. If you think about labor unions, for example, they've been an important part of the political socialization of lots of working people over a long period of time, although that's less common now than it used to be. There are groups that correspond to religious affiliations of one sort or another. So right-wing fundamentalist religious groups have been an increasingly important part of the Republican coalition over the last 50 years or so. Lots of people have strong regional identities or loyalties. And so one of the stories we tell in the book is of the momentous transformation of the loyalties of white Southerners beginning in the 1950s and continuing over most of the next half century. Those people had, for deep historical reasons, for a long time considered themselves to be Democrats, and that affiliation loosened, and gradually they developed an alternative affiliation with the Republican Party. And so the South has switched pretty dramatically over a period of time from being loyally Democratic to being loyally Republican, and that's had huge implications for national politics as well.
Yeah, I was struck in that passage by, you seem to downplay the importance of race in those evolutions, because the initial loyalty to the Democratic Party was revulsion against Lincoln, and then the revulsion against the Democrats was because Johnson signed the Civil Rights Bill and the Voting Rights Act. Am I seeing too much race there?
Well, I think race certainly plays an important part of it, but I guess our argument would be that what's important about it is the racial identity and the view of whites about their place and the place of African Americans in the social system rather than specific racial policies. The way this story is often told is that these Southern whites were racially conservative, and when the Democratic Party took a racially liberal position and the Republican Party took a racially conservative position in the 1960s, they all marched into the appropriate party given their policy preferences. But if you look at what actually happened, the white Southerners with conservative policy preferences were no more likely to be Republicans than the ones with more moderate racial policy preferences through a fairly long period of time. And then gradually, as the party images began to shift and crystallize again, the gap in policy preferences and ideology between Republicans and Democrats among white Southerners began to grow again. And so now we have a system in which their policy preferences are reinforcing and consistent with their partisanship. But in our view of the story, the partisanship drove the policy preferences as much or more than the policy preferences drove the partisanship.
In other words, people make these partisan choices based on some kind of psychological or emotional impulses and then conform their political philosophy to fit.
Yeah, that's mostly what happens. For some people, it's a kind of family inheritance, especially if the party system is stable over a fairly long period of time. People learn from their parents which side they're on and what that means. Sometimes people are moved from one party to another on the basis of some particularly galvanizing issue that's important to them. And once they move for that reason, then they gradually begin to absorb all the other policy preferences and views about the world that tend to go along with that new partisanship. Sometimes it's these groups that shift on the basis of local political considerations or particular individual leaders who draw people into a party, and then they begin to pick up what the party is about. So some of the people who weren't Republicans who voted for Trump in 2016 may come to think of themselves as Republicans over time if Trumpism and Republicanism manage to hang together as a coherent alliance for a while.
Okay, Trump. What, if anything, has the election of Donald Trump, well, the campaign of 2016 and the election of Trump, done to your thinking? I mean, do you look at that result and say, told you so, or do you say, I think I have to rethink everything?
I think it's certainly clear from our book that these kinds of things can happen in democratic political systems. Obviously, we didn't write about Trump because he was just emerging on the scene at the time that the book was published. We have a kind of parallel story about a wacky social movement in the Canadian province of Alberta that was instigated by a religious preacher, radio commentator. It was a period in which there was vulnerability because the party system was kind of up in the air. There was a lot of disaffection because of the economic distress of the Great Depression, and people flocked to this guy who had basically invented his own kind of wacky ideology because they were dissatisfied with the established political leaders on both sides. And that's a kind of common story in democratic systems. If you have a well-established pattern of competition among political elites, and for one reason or another, people become dissatisfied with both of them, then they're likely to be vulnerable to almost any alternative. And Trump came along as an alternative that was appealing to people who were dissatisfied with the elites on both sides. I don't want to push that idea too far because I think actually that the most striking fact about the 2016 election is how many Republicans voted for Trump in spite of everything. The exit polls claim that it was 90%, which is pretty consistent with the proportion of Republicans who voted for John McCain in 2008 or for Mitt Romney in 2012. I've seen some survey data of people going back to 2011 and claiming that people who said they were Republicans in 2011 were over 90% certain to vote for Trump in 2016. So in spite of how different he was as a candidate and the kinds of things that he has done and stood for that differ in some important ways from the traditional Republican view, these people's party identities and party loyalties in the end proved to be sufficiently strong for them to overlook all of that and support this guy who was in some sense an anti-establishment figure but was the putative leader of their party.
But we've also seen an incredible mobilization coming from the Democratic side of massive protests and actions to protect immigrants and to occupy airports over the travel ban. What does that say to you?
Well, I mean, it says that people are worked up. I think that's in part a function of the shocking result. If people had known for 6 months before the election that Trump was going to win, I think they would have adjusted to this. People on the left went into election night thinking that Hillary Clinton was going to be the next president. I'm dubious about the actual political impact of all that activity. I mean, in some ways, the activity itself is consistent with what the folk theory would suggest about how people ought to respond to this kind of political crisis. But the mechanisms by which that energy and passion and activity would actually be translated into policy change are pretty murky.
What, if anything, can we do to make our society more democratic? Is it something we want to do, or should we just sort of shrug and accept that this is the best we can do in a fallen world?
Well, if democratic means to try to translate the preferences of ordinary citizens as directly as possible into policy, I think that's probably not a worthy goal. I think we have to have a more nuanced view of politics in which we allow for the fact that there really is political expertise that's necessary to run a country, that political leaders can do lots of things that aren't simply reflections of their citizens or their followers' preferences that turn out to be good for them and for the country as a whole. So we need to, I think, go back to the more realistic view of human nature and the governmental process that underlined or formed the basis for the way the founders thought about the American political system. They wanted ordinary people to have an important role and to be able to express their preferences and control their leaders, but they didn't imagine that the idea was to put ordinary people directly in charge of the political process. I think the biggest obstacle to constructive political change in the current climate probably is economic inequality. And that's something that I've written about before. It's an especially dramatic issue now given the run-up in inequality in the U.S. and other affluent democracies over the last 50 years. But I think it's almost always the case that policymaking processes attach a lot of influence to the preferences and interests of affluent people and much less to the preferences and interests of ordinary and working class and poor people. There have been various attempts to address that problem, all of which fail in part because they take too seriously the folk theory, and they imagine that if only we could convince these poor people to turn out and vote, everything would be fixed. I think there are lots of complicated ways in which economic power gets transmuted into political power, and that probably the only way to dampen that kind of inequality is to dampen the economic inequality in the first place, but that in itself is really difficult.
That was Larry Bartels, a professor of political science at Vanderbilt and co-author, along with Christopher Aiken, of Democracy for Realists from Princeton University Press. I have to say that I'm not convinced by his analysis of the republicanization of Southern whites. I think race and racism played the dominant role. The Confederate flag may be a symbol of regional pride, but it's more importantly a symbol of slavery and white supremacy. And that symbolism is never far from the surface and never far from notions of regional pride, protest to the contrary. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a bit of Beethoven's Consecration of the House Overture, performed by the Minnesota Orchestra under Stanislaw Skrobacheski. I just love the prancing bassoon. According to the orchestra's website, Skrobacheski, a composer as well as a conductor, approaching his 94th birthday, is working on a non-religious requiem for civilization, but still with hope for the future. I hope he straightens all that out for us. Till next week, bye.